Aaron slides the elevator door open with his free hand. Metal provides considerable resistance. The activators emit a screech as they are buckled by the pressure he exerts. He steps into darkness. Field function scans and infrared imaging reveal the short, empty corridor ahead. He walks along it with the zombie Wirtz marching beside him until they reach the large vault door of meta-bonded malmetal at the end. Both wall and door are guarded by a strong force field that is powered independently from within. His free hand strokes across the undefended corridor wall until his fingers are resting over the armored conduit carrying part of the security net's cabling. He presses down. A small disruptor pulse disintegrates the concrete. Dust pours out, and he pushes his hand deeper into the hole. He has to excavate up to his elbow until he reaches the conduit. There is a brief clash of energy fields, and the conduit shatters, exposing the optical cables inside. The fingertips of his hand extrude slender filaments that penetrate the optical cables, immersing themselves in the blaze of coherent light flashing along the interior. His enrichments are interfaced directly into the smart core through an unprotected link. A torrent of destructive software is unleashed by his U-shadow, corroding the smart core's primary routines like acid on skin. In the first 8 milliseconds of the assault, the smart core loses over half of its intellectual processing capacity. Its default preservation routines withdraw its connections to the vault security system, allowing it to retreat and lick its wounds in isolation. Aaron's U-shadow turns its attention to the connections along the other end of the expropriated optical cable and examines the security network inside the vault. It takes less than a second to map the system's nodes and cubes, allowing it to remove the smart core's control and safeguard procedures. The force field switches off, and the thick door opens with a low swish of retracting malmetal. Aaron removes his hand from the ragged hole. He and Wirtz walk forward in tandem, passing through the air dust shield with a gentle buzz. Independent lighting panels click on, revealing a shiny oblong chamber filled with floor-to-ceiling racks of translucent pink plastic cubes. The registry is a simple, slim pedestal of metal just inside. Wirtz accesses the dormant software within. She is asked for her DNA-based authority certificate. As he passes the threshold, Aaron's field scans reveal two strange energy signatures emerging from the walls on either side of the vault. It is the final failsafe to protect the priceless 500,000 secure memory cells within the vault, not listed anywhere in the security net inventory, and quietly imported from a central world where such technology is unexceptional. Two guards with heavy weapons enrichments are sealed within the temporal suspension zone of exotic matter cages. Their enrichments were fully powered up when they began their 2-year duty period. They do not ask questions as they step back into real time. They simply open fire. Aaron's force field immediately is pushed close to overload as it struggles to protect him and Wirtz. His disadvantage is terribly obvious as energy beams pummel him and the woman. Dense waves of scarlet photons ignite with blinding ferocity around his chest and arms. He staggers back half a step. Send authority certificate. But the pedestal uses non-military-grade hardware. It cannot receive and acknowledge any information in such a hostile electromagnetic environment. Shit. His bandolier belts launch a flock of electronic countermeasure drones and 5 Niling sponges. The guards twist away from the threat, ducking behind the racks. Aaron reaches out with his free hand and manages to grip the top of the pedestal as the last of the energy barrage drains away from his force field. The filaments emerge from his fingertips and try to burrow into the nodes and cables underneath the metal. Both guards spin out from behind the racks and open fire again. The Niling sponges cluster together and activate their absorption horizons. Energy beams from the weapons curve bizarrely through the hot air to sink harmlessly into the black star blooms drifting sedately in front of Aaron. Their horizons start to expand significantly. The guards shift to kinetic carbines. Their hypervelocity projectiles are unaffected by the Niling sponges and smash against Aaron and Wirtz. The force field flares bright copper, shading up toward carmine. Aaron can feel the strain the impacts are punishing his body with. Reinforcement fields are struggling to hold him upright. On your knees. Wirtz sinks quickly to the shiny floor, presenting a smaller, more stable target. His filaments have penetrated the metal casing of the pedestal and begin to affiliate themselves with the fine mesh of optical strands beneath. A couple of energy dumpers skim toward Aeron. He shoots them with a simple ion shot from an enrichment in his forearm. His force field has to reformat momentarily to allow the ions through. It is a weakness that the guards exploit ruthlessly, concentrating their fire. He feels the kinetic projectiles lance into his shoulder and upper torso. Combat software reports 5 direct hits. Field scans reveal the nature of the foreign projectiles. Number 1 is a straight explosive, which is countered by a damping field, turning it to a lump of white, hot metal. 2 releases a pack of fire wire tangles, which expand through his flesh, ripping it apart at a cellular level, incinerating as they go, wrecking bionic organelles. They can be staved off only by a specific frequency disruptor field that attacks their molecular structure, that has a debilitating effect on the bionics, still functional in the area. 3 dispenses a nerve agent in sufficient quantity to exterminate 500 humans. Bionics converge quickly to counteract the deadly toxin. 4 is another explosive, neutralized along with 1. 5 is a cluster of micro-janglers, microbe-sized generators that jam his nervous system, inhibiting bionic and enrichment operations. A secondary function is to induce pain impulses. They require a scrambler field to kill them. Blood pumps out from the cratered flesh and torn suit, to be flattened back beneath the reformatted force field. The surrounding fabric of his suit is saturated quickly. Bionics congregate around the edge of the wounds, acting in concert to knit the damage back together, sealing up veins, arteries, and capillaries. Inside his body, the firewire tangles halt their expansion as the disruptor sabotages their molecular cohesion. It is too slow. They are causing a massive amount of damage, damage that is amplified by the micro-janglers. Aeron flings his head back to scream in agony as the microscopic technology war is fought within his muscles and blood vessels, but still he keeps hold of both Wirtz and the pedestal. His bionics shut off a whole series of nerves, eliminating the pain and all sensation in his shoulder and arm. A disconcertingly large section of the medical status display in his exovision is flashing red. Nausea plagues him, shivers run along his limbs. The field medic sac in his thigh pushes a dose of suppressants into his bloodstream. Another wave of kinetics pounds him. He is in danger of falling backward. His bionics and enrichments are reaching maximum capacity. Countermeasures drones do their best to confuse the enemy targeting sensors, but the narrow confines of the vault make such systems almost irrelevant. His filaments interface with the registry cube in the pedestal. Send authority certificate. The registry software acknowledges Wirtz's authority, and the U-Shadow runs a search for Inigo's secure store. It locates the memory cell. The physical coordinates are loaded into Aeron's combat routines, a volume of 8 cubic centimeters to be held inviolate. The rest of the vault structure is now expendable. He lets go of the pedestal and Wirtz. The woman slumps forward, a motion that jolts her unsecured brain. A fresh upwelling of blood bubbles out around the circle of cut bone. The protective swirl of Nihiling sponges deactivates, their black horizons folding in on themselves. Aeron raises his head and smiles an animal snarl through the clear air at the guards. Their barrage has paused as they take stock. "Pay back time," he growls enthusiastically. The first disruptor pulse smashes out. Half the precious racks rupture in a maelstrom of molten plastic. Both guards stagger backward. Jelly gun shots hammer at their force fields. Energy dumpers zip about, launched by both sides. Black Nihiling horizons expand and contract like inverse novas. Kinetic projectiles chew into the vault's concrete and marble walls. More racks suffer, shattering like antique glass. The plastic catches fire, molten rivulets streaking across the floor, spitting feeble flames from their leading edges. Aeron positions himself between the guards and Inigo's memory cell, shielding it from any possible damage. He manages to puncture the force field of one guard's leg and fires the jelly gun into the gap. The leg instantly transforms to a liquid pulp of ruined cells. The guard screams as he topples over. His force field reconfigures over the stump, allowing the blood and gore to splash across the ground, where it starts to steam softly. Energy dumpers attach themselves to him like predatory rodents. He thrashes about helplessly as his force field diminishes. Now it is just Aaron and the remaining guard. They advance on each other, each trusting in his own weapons enrichments. This is no longer a battle of software or even human wits. It is brute strength only that will prevail now. At the end, they resemble two atomic fireballs colliding. A shockwave of incandescent energy flares out from the impact, vaporizing everything it touches. One fireball is extinguished abruptly. Aaron stands over the clutter of charcoal that seconds before was his opponent. While still staring down, he extends his good arm sideways. An X-ray laser muzzle emerges from his forearm. Its beam slices through the head of the legless guard, curves up to annihilate the man's memory cell. Aaron lets out a long sigh, then winces at the dull pain throbbing deep in his shoulder. When he glances at it, the bloodstain has spread across most of his chest. The hole torn and burned through the suit fabric reveals nothing but a mangled patch of blackened skin seeping blood. His medical monitors report that the firewire tangles have burrowed deep. The damage is extensive. Sharp stabs of pain from his left leg make him gasp. His knee almost gives way. Bionics act in concert to trace and eliminate the micro-janglers that are cruising recklessly through his bloodstream. If they infiltrate his brain, he will be in serious trouble. The medical sack still is pumping drugs into him to counter shock. Blood loss will become a problem very soon unless he can reach a medical facility. However, he remains functional, though he will have to undergo decontamination for the nerve agent. His bionics are not satisfied they have located all the toxin. The field scan function fine-tunes itself and scans again. Aaron walks over to the rack containing Inigo's memory cell. Niling sponges flutter through the air and return to his bandolier, snuggling back into their pouches. His feet crunch on a scree of fragments before squelching on blood and plastic magma. Then the memory cell is in his hand, and the most difficult stage of the mission is over. Flames are taking hold across Wirtz's uniform as he walks out of the vault. She has not moved from her kneeling position. Aaron shoots her through the head with the X-ray laser, an act of mercy, in case her memory cell is still recording impulses. It is not like him, but he can afford to be magnanimous in the face of success. 3 minutes later, Aaron made it out onto the roof of the administration block. He walked over to the edge, drawing breath in short gasps. The numb shoulder wound had started to cold burn, radiating out waves of dizziness that his medical enrichments could barely prevent from overwhelming him. A terrible burst of pain from his legs, stomach, and spine drilled into him, blinding him as he convulsed. Unseen in his exovision displays, the bionics reported progress in their quest to trace and eliminate the remaining elusive micro-janglers still contaminating his blood. Slowly, stiffly, he straightened up again, teetering close to a two-story fall. His U-shadow reconnected to the Unisphere as soon as he clambered out of the elevator shaft and reported that the remnant of the Smart Corps was yelling for help on just about every link the clinic had with the Unisphere. "Police tactical troops are responding," the U-shadow informed him. "Clinic security officers are arming themselves. Perimeter is sealing." "We'd better leave, then," Aaron said with bravado. He winced again at a shiver of phantom pain from his collarbone and called Corilin. "Let's go. I'm at designated position 1A.
"Oh," she replied. "Are you finished already?"
For a moment he thought she was joking. "What?"
"I didn't realize you'd be that quick."
Anger swiftly turned him to ice. The schedule he had given her had been utterly clear-cut. Not even the unexpected guards and subsequent firefight had delayed him more than 40 seconds. "Where are you?" His exovision was showing him a local map with the police cruisers closing on the clinic at Mach 8.
I'm still in the reception area. You know, they have some really nice clothes here. And Ruth Stahl has actually been quite useful with styling. Who'd have thought it? I've already tried on a couple of these lovely wool...
"Get the fuck
Into the capsule! Right fucking now! He screamed.
Tactical software assessed the situation, corresponding with his own instinct. The roof was far too exposed. Another involuntary shudder ran up his legs, and he went with it, tumbling over the edge, totally reliant on his combat software. The program formatted his force field to cushion his landing. Even so, the pain seemed to explode directly into his brain as he thudded into the ground. He rolled over and stumbled to his feet, far too slowly.
The doors won't open, Corilin said. I can't get to the capsule. The alarm is going off. Wait, Ruth is telling me not to move.
Aaron groaned as he staggered erratically across the band of lawn surrounding the administration block. Not that the trees would provide the slightest cover, not against the kinds of forces heading for him. Seeking darkness was a simple animal instinct.
Take the bitch out, he told Corilin. What?
Hit ha! Here's a combat program, he said as his U-shadow shunted the appropriate file at her. Go for a disabling blow. Don't hesitate.
I can't do that.
Hit ha, and call the capsule over. It can smash through the doors for you.
Aaron, can't I just get the capsule to break in? I'm really not comfortable hitting someone without warning.
Aaron reached the tree line. His legs gave way, sending him sprawling in the dirt and spiky vines. Pain that had nothing to do with the micro-janglers pulsed from his damaged shoulder.
Help!
He croaked. Oh, fuck it, Corilin. Get the capsule here. He started crawling. His exo-images were a blurred scintillation coursing around his constricting vision.
Hey, she's grabbed me.
Corilin.
Cow!
I can't make it. He pushed against the damp, sandy soil with his good arm, trying to lever himself back onto his feet. Two police capsules flashed silently overhead. A second later, their hypersonic boom smashed him back down onto the ground. Tree branches splintered from the violence of the sound. Aaron whimpered as he rolled onto his back.
Oh, Ozzy, there's blood everywhere. I think I've broken her nose. I didn't hit her hard, really. Get me,
he whispered. He sent a single command thought to the Nihiling sponges in his bandolier harness. The little spheres soared away into the night, arching away over the waving trees. Violet laser beams sliced through the air, as bright as lightning forks. He grinned weakly.
Wrong,
he told the unseen police capsules. The Nihiling sponges sucked down the energy that the capsules pumped into them. Theoretically, the Nihiling effect could absorb billions of kilowatt-hours before reaching the saturation point. Aaron had programmed in a limit. When the police weapons pumped their internal levels to that limit, the absorption effect reversed. Five huge explosions blossomed high over the forest, sending out massive clashing pressure waves. The police capsules could not be damaged by the blast. Their force fields were far too strong for that. But the wave fronts sent them tumbling through the night sky, spinning and flailing out beyond the edge of the forest as the re-grav drives fought to counter the force. Down below, trees tumbled before the bedlam, as if they were no stronger than paper, crashing into one another to create a domino effect radiating out from the five blast centers. A blizzard of splinters and gravel snatched Aaron off the ground and sent him twirling 5 meters to bounce badly. Amazingly, he was still holding the memory cell as he found himself flat on his back, gazing up into a sky beset with an intricate webbing of lambent ion streamers.
Corilin,
he called desperately. Above him, the pretty sky was dimming to infinite black. There were no stars to be seen as the darkness engulfed him. Inigo's fourth dream. After breaking camp just after dawn, the caravan was on the road for 3 hours before it finally topped the last ridge and the coastal plain tipped into view. Ediard smiled down on it with an adrenaline burst of enthusiasm. With nearly a year spent traveling, he finally was looking at his future. Riding on the G-horse beside him, Salrana squealed happily and clapped her hands. Several pigs in the back of Olrani's cart grunted at the sudden noise. Ediard ordered his G-horse to stop. The caravan pushed on inexorably, wagon after wagon rolling down the stony road. Directly ahead of him, the foothills of the Donsori Mountains fell away sharply to the awesome Iguru Plain below. It stretched away for mile after long mile, a flat expanse of rich farmland, almost all of which was under cultivation, its surface marked out in huge regular fields filled with verdant crops. A massive grid of ditches fed into wide, shallow rivers, delineated by protective earthen embankments. Forests tended to sprawl around the lower slopes of the odd little volcanic cones that broke the plain's uniformity. As far as he could see, there was no pattern to the steep knolls. They were dotted purely at random. It was a strange geography, completely different from the rugged surrounding terrain. He shrugged at the oddity and squinted toward the eastern horizon. Part imagination, part horizon haze, the Lyat Sea was just visible as a grey line. No need to imagine the city, though. Macathran bestrode the horizon like a sun-washed pearl. At first he was disappointed by how small it was, but then he began to appreciate the distance involved. "Quite something, isn't it?" Barker said, as he rode his aged G-horse level with Ediard.
"Yes, sir,"
Ediard said. Additional comment seemed superfluous.
"How far away are we?"
"It'll take at least another half a day for us to get down to the plain. This last stretch of road down the mountains is tricky. We'll make camp at Clipsham, the first decent-sized town on the Iguru. Then it'll be near enough another day to reach Macathran itself." He nodded pleasantly and urged his G-horse onward.
Almost 2 days away. Ediard stared, entranced at the capital city, allegedly the only true city on Querencia. The caravan had visited some fabulous towns on their route, large conurbations with wealthy populations. Several had parks bigger than Ashwell. At the time he had thought them grand, sure that nothing could actually be larger.
"Lady, what a bumpkin I am."
"Doubts here, of all places?"
Salrana asked. "Those are some very melancholy thoughts you've got growing in your head there."
"Just humbled," he told her.
Her thoughts sparkled with amusement, producing a teasing smile.
"Thinking of Franley?"
"Not for months," he answered with high dignity. Salrana laughed wickedly. He had met Franley in Plax, a provincial capital on the other side of the Ulfsan Mountains. A spree of bad luck on the road, including broken wheels and sick animals, as well as unusually early autumn storms, meant the caravan was late reaching Plax. As a consequence, they had been snowed in for over 6 weeks. That was when he had met Franley, an Eggshaper Guild apprentice and his first real love affair. They had spent most of the awful cold weather together, either in bed or exploring the town's cheaper taverns. The Eggshaper Guild's master had recognized his talent, offering him a senior apprenticeship with the promise of journeyman status in a year. He had been this close to staying. But in the end, his last promise to Akim gave him a stronger direction. Leaving had been so painful. He had been sullen and withdrawn for weeks as the caravan lumbered slowly along the snowy Ulfsan valleys. A misery to live with, the rest of the caravan had grumbled. It took the remainder of winter and putting the Ulfsans between himself and Plax before he recovered. That and Rosalyn, in one of the mountain villages, and Dalis, and, well, several more girls between there and here.
"Look at it," he said earnestly. "We did the right thing."
Salrana tipped her head back, half closing her eyes against the bright morning light.
"Forget the city," she said. "I've never seen so much sky."
When he glanced up, he understood what she meant. Their high vantage point gave them a view into the azure infinity that roofed the plain. Small bright clouds scudded far overhead, wisps so tenuous that they were almost sapphire themselves. They seemed to twist as they traced long arcs above the Iguru, before hitting the mountain thermals, where they expanded and darkened. "The wind above the city always blows in from the sea," he remembered Akim saying. "And when it turns around, watch out."
"What's that smell?"
he asked, puzzled. The air was fresh, zingy almost, yet somehow tainted at the same time. There was laughter from the wagon that rolled past.
"You backward village boy," Alcus, the driver, mocked. "That's the smell of the sea."
Etiard dropped his gaze back down to the horizon. He'd never seen the sea before. In truth, from this distance it did not look like much, a grey-blue smudge line. He supposed it would become more interesting and impressive as they drew nearer. "Thank you, old man," he called back, and supplied a fast hand gesture. By now he was on good terms with just about every family in the caravan. Abandoning them in Macathran was going to be at least as hard as leaving Plax.
"Come on,"
Salrana said. She ordered her G-horse forward. After a moment, Etiard followed suit.
"I was talking to Magrith at breakfast," Salrana said. "She told me this road was the same one Ra travelled on when he led his shipmates out of the strife that followed their landing on Quarentia. He would have seen the city for the first time from this very spot."
"Wonder what he made of the Uguru," Etiard muttered.
"There are times when I really don't understand you, Etiard. We've reached Macathran, which I only ever half believed in anyway. Us two. Ashwell villagers, no less. I hear at the centre of our whole world. And all you do is talk about the stupid farmland outside. I'm sorry, this place is odd, that's all. Look around. The mountains just end, like something cut them off. I'm sure there's a geography guild, if you're that interested," she sniffed.
"Now that's an idea," he said with sudden apparent interest. "Do you think it would be hard to get into?"
"Oh!"
she squealed in exasperation. Her third hand shoved against him, trying to push him off his saddle. He pushed back and sent her hunching down, tightening her grip on the reins.
"Etiard, careful!"
"Sorry." It was a standing joke along the caravan that he did not know his own strength. He shook his head and concentrated on the phalanx of Genistars walking alongside the caravan, making sure the G-horses were pulling the wagon in a straight line. The G-wolves kept close, and the G-eagles spiraled wide. The surface of the road was excellent. Laid with large flat stones and well-maintained, it was almost like a town pavement. But then it was the main road through the mountains, and led directly to the capital. Both eyes and farsight picked out several wagons and small convoys wending their way up and down the broad switchbacks ahead of them. He also saw a group of men on horseback, accompanied by G-wolves, who were picking their way leisurely up the road. They would reach the head of the caravan by noon, he reckoned. With his senses open wide, he slowly grew aware of the city's emanations. It was a quiet background burble, similar to the aura of any human settlement, except that this time he was too far away to be sensing Macathran's population, no matter how talented and receptive he was. Besides, this had a different tempo from human minds. It was slower and much more content. It was the essence of a lazy summer afternoon, distilled into a single long harmonic, pleasant and relaxing. He yawned. "Etiard," Salrana called. He blinked, the worry in her mind switching him to full alertness. His G-horse was meandering close to the edge of the road, not that it was dangerous. There was no sheer slope until farther down the hill where the switchbacks began. Here there was just uneven ground and the curving crest. A quick couple of instructions to the G-horse's mind corrected his direction.
"Let's try and arrive intact," she said scathingly. "Lady, but your riding is still terrible."
He was too disquieted to try to correct her with their usual banter. He no longer could sense the city's lumbering thoughts. Too much adrenaline was pumping through his veins. Now that the city was in sight, he was getting genuinely excited. At last, the dreadful past was well and truly behind them. It was midday when the caravan drew to a gradual halt amid the groaning of wood and metal brakes, the snorting of animals and the quiet grumbles of humans. They were strung out over half a mile, curving around one of the longer switchbacks, which made it awkward for anyone else trying to use the road. The captain of the militia patrol who made them stop was mildly apologetic, but insistent nonetheless. Etiard was only a couple of wagons behind the front as Barkus asked, "Is there a problem, sir? This is our annual trip. We are well known to all the civic authorities." "I know you myself, Barkus," the captain said, as he eyed the caravan's G-wolves. He was sitting on a midnight black terrestrial horse, looking very splendid in a ceremonial blue and scarlet tunic, with polished brass buttons gleaming down the jacket. Ediard used his farsight to examine the revolver in the man's white leather holster. It was remarkably similar to the one that had belonged to Genril's family. The rest of the militiamen were similarly armed. They certainly were not carrying anything like the fast-firing gun of the bandits. Ediard did not know if that was a good thing. If the city did possess such weapons, they probably would not be put out on show with a patrol like this. However, I don't remember you having so many G-wolves before, the captain said. We were in the Rulan province last year. A village was sacked by bandits. Farms suffered losses in raids. You can't be too careful. Damned savages, the captain spit. Probably just two tribes fighting over some whore. I don't know why you venture out there, Barkus. They're all bandits and ne'er-do-wells, if you ask me. Ediard slowly sat up very straight, keeping his gaze fixed on the captain. He strengthened the shield around him. Do nothing, Barkus shot at him in a long, talk whisper. Ediard, Salrana hissed quietly. He could sense the rage in her thoughts, barely contained. All around him, the minds of his friends were radiating dismay and sympathy. But profitable, Barkus continued smoothly. We can buy very cheaply indeed out there. The captain laughed, unaware of the emotional storm gathering around him. For which my friends in the city will pay greatly, I suppose. That's the essence of trade, Barkus said. After all, we do travel at considerable risk. Well, good luck to you, Barkus, but I am responsible for the safety of Macathran. So I must request that you keep your beasts on a leash within the city walls. They won't be used to civilization. We don't want any unfortunate accidents. Of course. You might want to get them accustomed to the idea as soon as you reach the plain. I'll see to it. Good. And no trading with the denizens of the Sampaloc district, eh? Absolutely not. The captain and his men turned around and rode off down the road, their pack of G-wolves chasing along behind them. Barkus saw the caravan start off again, then urged his G-horse back to Ediard and Salrana. I'm sorry you had to hear that, he said. They're not all like that in the city, are they? Salrana asked anxiously. Sweet lady, no. Officers in the militia are usually the younger sons of an old family, little idiots who know nothing of life. Their birth provides them with a great deal of arrogance, but no money. The militia allows them the illusion of continuing status, while all they actually do is search for a wealthy wife. Thankfully, they can do no real harm, patrolling out here. Ediard was almost shocked by the notion. If they need money, why don't they join a guild and develop their psychic talent or begin a new business? To his surprise, Barkus burst out laughing. Oh, Ediard, for all the distance you've travelled with us, you still have so much further to go. A nobleman's son earn a living? He laughed again before ordering his G-horse back to the next wagon. After Clipsham, Ediard wanted to take a horse and gallop across the Uguru until he reached Macathran. Surely it would take no more than a few hours. However, he managed to keep his impatience in check and dutifully plodded alongside the wagons, helping to soothe the G-wolves, which were unused to being leashed. It was warm down on the plain, a gentle constant wind blowing a sea-humid air that Ediard found strangely invigorating. Winter here was a lot shorter than he was used to in the Rulan province, Barkus explained, though those months could see some very sharp frosts and several snow blizzards. By contrast, summer in the city was very hot and lasted for more than 5 months. Most of the grand families kept villas in the Donsori Mountains, where they spent the height of the hot season. The Iguru's farmland reflected the climate, with luxuriant growth covering every field. The road was lined with tall, slender palm trees cloaked in ribbons of cobalt moss and sprouting tufts of scarlet and emerald leaves right at the top. Crops were different from those Ediard was used to. There were few cereal fields here, but plenty of citrus groves and fruit plantations, with acre after acre of vines and fruiting bushes. Some cane fields were being burned black, sending black smoke plumes churning high into the clear sky. It was volcanic soil underfoot, which contributed as much to the healthy verdant hue of the vegetation as did the regular rain and sun-soaked sky. Armies of G-chimps bustled about over the land, tending to the plants, with supervisors riding among them on horses. The farmhouses were grand whitewashed buildings with red clay tile roofs, as big as the guild compounds back in Ashwell. Despite all the hours they spent rolling forward that morning, the panorama on both sides of the straight road remained unnervingly similar. Only the volcanic cones offered landmarks by which to measure progress. Ediard could see veins of silver streams running down their slopes, before vanishing into the dense skirts of dark jade trees. But there were no caldera crowns. They rose to simple, rounded crests. On many of them, cottages had been built on narrow ledges, compact yet elaborate constructions that his friends explained were little more than pavilions in which the city's wealthy spent languid days enjoying the fabulous view. It was common to install a favoured mistress in one. Traffic began to increase as they neared Macathran. Terrestrial horses were now more common than G-horses, with their riders wearing expensive clothes. Wagons piled high with produce from the farms and estates of the plain lumbered toward the markets and merchant warehouses. Fancy carriages with curtained windows rattled past. Ediard was surprised to find them shielded from casual farsight by a mild variant of his own concealment ability. Their footmen radiated sullen anger, discouraging anyone from prying. The final approach to the city walls was home to an astonishing variety of trees. Ancient black and grey trunks sentried the road on either side, sending gnarled boughs overhead to form twined arches that were centuries old. At first, Ediard thought there had been some kind of earthquake recently. All the trees, no matter their age and size, leaned one way, their branches bowing in the same direction. Then it slowly dawned on him that the constant wind had shaped them, pushing their branches away from the shoreline. For the last quarter of a mile, the ground was simple, flat meadow, home to flocks of sheep. When they left the shelter of the trees, Ediard was awarded his first sight of the city since they had descended from the foothills. The crystal wall faced them, rising sheer out of the grass to a height of 30 yards. Although transparent, it had a gold hue, distorting the silhouettes of the buildings inside and making it impossible to gather a true impression of what lay within. It formed a perfect circle around the city, the same height all the way around except for the port on the eastern side, where it dipped down to allow the sea to wash against the quays. Quarencia's gentle tides had no visible effect on it. The stubborn crystal was as immune to erosion forces as it was to all other forms of assault. Neither bullets nor pickaxes could chip it. Glue did not stick to it. As a defensive barrier, it was nearly perfect. Its only known susceptibility was to telekinesis, which could wear down its strength gradually. That was how Ra had opened the city to his people. A powerful telekinetic, he systematically cut through the crystal, shaping 3 gateways. Legend said that each one took him 2 years to carve out. His followers fixed the huge detached segments to giant metal hinges, transforming them into tightly fitting gates. In the 2 millennia since, they had been shut only 8 times. For the last 700 years, they had remained open. The caravan passed through the north gate. It was 7 yards wide at the base, arching up 10 yards above Ediard's head, and the passageway into the city was 3 yards long. The gate was hinged back flat against the wall on the inside. He found it hard to believe that the huge thing could move. The hinges seemed wondrously primitive contraptions, all bulbous iron joints and girders studded with rivets. Yet they had not corroded, and the pivots were kept oiled. Directly inside, to the left of the road, was a broad swath of paddock land named the High Moat, which followed the wall's curve around to the upper tail district next to the port. As horses were prohibited from the main districts, many families maintained stables there, simple wooden buildings that had been added to over the centuries. There were also stockades for cattle and traveller pens, even a couple of cheap markets. On the opposite side of the road, the similar crescent of low moat led around to the main gate. Running around the inner edge of the moats was the North Curve Canal, lined with the same whitish material from which the majority of the city had been fabricated, resembling icy marble, yet stronger than any metal humans could forge on Quarencia. Ediard stared enchanted at the gondolas as they slid along the canal.
He had seen boats before. Thorpe by Water had them in abundance, as did many other towns. Yet those were coarse workaday cousins compared with these elegant black craft. They had shallow keels with tall prows rising out of the water carved into elegant figures. The cushioned benches of the midsection were protected from the hot sun by white awnings, and the gondolier stood on a platform at the stern, manipulating a long punt pole with easy grace. Each gondola was home to at least a couple of G-cats. Ediard smiled happily at the traditional genistar forms, which were swarming in and out of the salty water. Unlike the bloated creatures he had shaped back in Ashwell, these were streamlined aquatics with webbed feet and long, sinuous tails. The surface of the canal was alive with ripples, as they continually chased after nimble fill rats and chewed on strands of trilonweed to keep the canal clear.
"Oh, my great lady,"
Selrana gasped, gawping out at the city.
"We did the right thing," Ediard said with finality. "Yes, we did."
Now that he was inside the crystal wall, the true aura of the city was washing against him. He'd never sensed such vitality before, the kind of exhilarating emotional impact that could come only from so many people pursuing their hectic lives in close proximity. Individuality was impossible to distinguish, but the collective sensation was a powerhouse of animation. He felt uplifted simply by drinking in the sights and sounds. The caravan turned off the road. Barkus had a quick conversation with a city travel master who assigned them 3 pens on a high moat where they could set up to trade. The wagons rumbled along the narrow track to their final destination. Ediard and Selrana walked their G-horses over to Barkus's wagon. It was an act rich with association with that time back in Thorpe by Water when they had come to the caravan master for help. The old man's family had been setting up the awnings on either side of the ancient wagon. They had all been strangers back then, curious and suspicious. Now Ediard knew them all and counted them as friends, which made this so very difficult. Selrana's thoughts were subdued and morose as Barkus turned to face them. The old caravan master eyed the packs they were carrying.
"You're really going to stay here, then?"
"Yes, sir."
He hugged both of them. Selrana had to wipe tears from her eyes. Ediard was fighting to make sure the same thing did not happen to him.
"Have you got enough money?"
"Yes, sir. We're fine."
Ediard patted the pocket inside his trousers. Along the route he had sold enough G-spiders to pay for weeks in a lavishly appointed tavern, and he was dressed respectably again.
"If it doesn't work out, we'll be here for a week. You're welcome to come with us, both of you. You'll always have a home on the road with us."
"I will never forget your kindness," Ediard said.
"Nor I,"
Selrana added.
"Go on, then. Be off with you."
Ediard could see in the old man's agitated thoughts that this was just as painful for him. He gripped Barkus's arm and squeezed it tightly before turning away. Selrana threw her hands around the caravan master's neck and kissed him gratefully. The road that had brought them into the city ended just short of the North Curve Canal. They walked beside the waterway for a little while until they found a bridge over it. It was made from a tough, ochre-coloured variety of the ubiquitous city material, a simple low arch to which wooden railings had been added on either side. There were so many people using it, bustling against him, that Ediard had to clutch his shoulder bag tightly. But there were no animals, he realized, not even G-chimps. The bridge took them into the Ilongo district, which was made up of small box-like buildings 2 or 3 stories high, with vaulting Lierne roofs and walls that often leaned away from perpendicular. Windows followed no pattern. There were angled slits, crescents, teardrops, circles, ovals, but never squares. They all had panes of a thick transparent crystal that grew, shaped, and replenished itself in the same slow fashion as the structures themselves. Entrances were simple arched oblongs or ovals, cutting through ground floor walls. Humans had added the wooden doors, fixing hinges into the structure with nails hammered into place with telekinesis. Over the years, the pins would be ejected slowly by the city material as it repaired the puncture holes they had made, necessitating refixing every decade or so. The constant, sedate renewal of the city's fabric made the whole place look fresh, as if it had only just been completed. The gap between the buildings was narrow. Sometimes, beside a canted corner, there was barely a couple of feet left between walls, forcing Ediard to turn sideways to squeeze through. Other passages were broad pavements that allowed several people to walk side by side. They came across little squares and courtyards, all of which were provided with fountains of fresh water bubbling up through the top of a thick pillar. "Does nobody work?" Selrana asked in puzzlement after they had been thoroughly jostled for 10 minutes while negotiating the narrow pavements. "The whole city must be walking about." Ediard simply shrugged. The district was a confusing maze. It was also where he discovered that the city material was almost opaque to farsight. He could only sense the murkiest shapes on the other side of the walls, and he certainly could not perceive right through a building. He was not used to having his perception cut so short. It unnerved him slightly. Eventually he summoned his G-Eagle and sent it soaring above the roofs, mapping a way for them. He wanted to get to the Tosella district, where the Eggshaper Guild had its blue tower. It was the district to the east of Ilongo, separated from it by the Hidden Canal. Despite it being so close, they took 40 minutes to negotiate Ilongo before crossing the thin canal on a small wooden bridge. Tosella's buildings were on a much larger scale than the ones they had seen so far. They were long rectangular mansions with tall slit windows stacked on top of one another up to 6 stories high and topped with concentric ring domes that intersected like waves frozen in mid-swirl. The ground directly outside their walls was fenced off with high slender pillars, separating the public pavement from emblem mosaics of glittering primary color flecks. The ground floors were arched cloisters, enclosing central quads, where prim gardens grew in long troughs, under the cool, tinted light shining through the roof skylights high above. For the first time in the city, he sensed the minds of Genistars. A ground floor in one of the mansions had been converted into stables for them. He even glimpsed apprentices and journeymen scurrying around the quads, their thoughts anxious and subdued as they tried to keep in their master's good graces. It brought a smile to his face as he recalled some of Akim's more outrageous stories of an apprentice's life in Makathran. "I know everyone asks this," Selrana said as they tarried beside one of the huge mansions, admiring the subtle rainbow shades refracting off its glittering snow-white frontage. "But I wonder who built this place. I thought it was the First Lives. Isn't that what the lady said?" "It doesn't actually say that in any of her teachings. All she says is that the city was left by those who came before."
"They couldn't have been humans, then."
"What makes you say that?"
"Oh, we can use it well enough. The concept of shelter is universal, I suppose. But nothing here is quite right for us. For a start, there were no gates until Ra arrived.
So the builders sailed in and out via the sea. That certainly ties in with all the canals," she answered with a smile. "No."
He could not match her light humor. His gaze swept along the length of the mansion. The root of architecture was species-based, from the basic functionality to the aesthetic, and Makathran just did not fit human sensibilities. He felt out of place there. "Humans never built this place. We just adapted to it. Aren't you the know-it-all? And we've only been here an hour."
"Sorry," he grinned. "But it is intriguing, you have to admit that. They say Eerie District is the really weird one. That's where the Pythia has her church, which is the only building ever formed for humans. The city granted it to the lady so her flock would be close to the towers when the Sky Lords finally return."
"Towers?"
"Yes, that's where the Sky Lords alighted the last time they were here, the day they took Ra's spirit to its rest in Odin's Sea."
"Oh, hey, wait. You mean humans designed the lady's church?"
She gave a mock sigh. "See, if you'd ever bothered to turn up to church, you'd have known that. It's right there in the lady's scriptures."
He gave the mansion another suspicious look.
"That's like shaping Genistars, but with buildings. I wonder if the city builders brought the defaults to Corentia. If the Geography Guild turns you down, you could always apply to the History Guild." Cheeky. He took a swipe at her. Salrana danced away laughing and stuck her tongue out. Several passers-by gave her a curious look, unused to seeing a lady's novice behave in such a fashion. She pulled a contrite face and held her hands demurely behind her back, eyes and mind still sparkling with amusement. "Come on," he said. "The quicker we get to the Blue Tower, the quicker we get you locked up in the novice dormitory where you belong, out of harm's way and not causing any trouble. Remember our promise? I'm going to be Pythia, and you're going to be Mayor."
"Yeah," he grinned. "It might take a couple of years, but we'll do it." Her smile faded as her thoughts grew sober.
"Ediard, you won't forget me, will you?"
"Hey, of course not."
"I mean it, Ediard. Promise. Promise we'll still talk each day, even if it's just a long talk. Hello."
He held up a hand, palm toward her. "I swear on the lady that I won't forget you. Such a thing is just not possible.
Thank you."
Her impish smile returned. "Do you want to kiss me again before we both get locked up in separate dormitories each night?" He groaned in dismay.
"Maybe I should just leave with the caravan."
It was Salrana's turn to take a swipe at him.
The Blue Tower was in the middle of the Tasella district, standing at least twice the height of the biggest mansion they had seen so far. For its walls, the city material had shaded down to a dark azure that seemed to soak up the sunlight, as if the facade possessed its own nimbus of shadow. Standing at the base between flying buttresses that resembled ancient tree roots, Ediard felt intimidated by the heartland of his guild. Surely such a structure never had been intended to house a profession that existed to lighten the load of people's lives. It was more like a fortress in which bandits would dwell.
"Are you sure you want to do this?" Salrana asked uncertainly. She was just as daunted by the overpowering structure as he was.
Yes, I'm sure."
He wished the vacillation in his thoughts wasn't quite so blatant. They walked in through a wide door, whose resemblance to a giant mouth was uncomfortably obvious. Inside, the walls and floor changed to the darkest red, with a surface sheen to match polished wood. Strong beams of sunlight from the high lancet windows cut through the gloom of the broad entrance hall. Ediard did not know where to go. There did not seem to be any kind of official to direct visitors to the appropriate room. His determination was fading fast, leaving him stalled in the middle of the wide-open space.
"I somehow don't think this is where the apprentices have their dormitories," Salrana said from the side of her mouth.
There were several groups of men in the hall, all talking quietly together. They wore fine clothes under flowing fur-lined gowns, with the egg-in-a-twisted-circle crest of the guild embroidered in gold thread on the collars. Disapproving glances were cast at Salrana and Ediard, followed by a surprising number of people focusing their farsight on the youthful pair. Ediard's farsight alerted him to three guards armed with revolvers marching across the entrance hall. They wore light draw-silk jackets over their immaculate white cotton tunics. The guild crest was prominent on their helmets. The sergeant glowered at Ediard, but was marginally less hostile to Salrana when he saw she was in her full novice dress.
"You two," he grunted, "what's your business here?"
So much for the warm welcome to a fellow guild member from far away, Ediard thought dourly. Then he realized he was not at all intimidated by the guard. After bandits, the sergeant and his little squad seemed faintly ludicrous. "I am a journeyman of the guild," Ediard said, surprising himself by how level and authoritative his voice was. "I've come from Rulan province to complete my training." The sergeant looked as if he had bitten into a rotten fruit.
"You're very young to be calling yourself a journeyman. Where's your badge?"
"It's been a long journey," Ediard said, suddenly not wanting to explain what had happened to his village to someone who would never understand life beyond the city. "I lost it."
"I see. And your letter?"
"Letter?" The sergeant spoke slowly, contempt colouring his thoughts.
"Your letter of introduction to the guild from your master?"
"I have none."
"Are you trying to take the piss, sonny?"
"Your pardon, miss," he said grudgingly to Salrana. "Leave now before we take you to the courts of justice for trespass and theft."
"I have committed no theft," Ediard protested loudly. "My master was Akeem.
He died before writing a letter of introduction.
The only reason to trespass here is to thieve something from us, you little country shit, the sergeant snapped. Now you've gone fucked me off, and that's not good for you.
He reached for Ediard, then blinked in surprise, as his hand slithered off an extremely strong telekinetic shield.
Oh, you asked for this.
His third hand tried to grab. Ediard warded him off easily, then hoisted the guard off the ground. The man yelled in shock as his feet kicked out.
"Take the little shit down!" he cried at his men.
Their third hands closed around Ediard to no avail. They went for their pistols, finding their arms moving slowly through impossibly thick air.
"Ediard!"
Salrana squeaked. Ediard could not quite comprehend how things had turned so crazy so fast.
"Enough!" a baritone voice commanded.
Ediard's farsight showed him an old man walking across the hall toward them. Long robes flowed behind him as he strode forward. He wore ochre trousers, cut high, so that his curving belly did not overhang, and a baggy shirt to continue the discreet disguise. But his weight was obvious from the pudgy fingers to the rolling neck and heavy jowls. Yet he carried himself with the vitality of a man half his age. Even without sensing his regimented thoughts, he was obviously a man of considerable authority.
"Put him down," he ordered Ediard.
"Yes, sir," Ediard said meekly. He knew this was a master equal to Akim. "I apologize. I was left little ch—"
"Be quiet."
The man turned to the sergeant, who was straightening his clothes, not making eye contact with anyone.
"And you, sergeant, need to keep your temper in check.
I am not prepared to have the Blue Tower guarded by petty-minded paranoia. You will learn a more rational attitude, or you'll see your days out guarding a guild estate on the other side of the Donsori Mountains. Do I make myself clear?"
"Sir."
"Away with you, while I determine how big a threat this boy presents."
The sergeant led his men away, but not before managing a last look at Ediard that promised dire vengeance.
"Your name, boy?"
"Ediard, sir."
"And I am Topar, a master of the Guild Council, and deputy to Grand Master Finneton. That should give you an idea of how deep you just dipped yourself in default crap. My lady's novice, may I inquire your name?"
"Salrana."
"I see. And I judge that both of you have only recently arrived in Macathran, correct?"
"Yes, sir," Ediard said. "I'm really sorry about—"
Topar waved an irritated hand. "I should be annoyed, but the name Akim hasn't been heard in our august tower for a considerable time. I am intrigued. Did I hear you say he is dead?"
"Yes, sir. I'm afraid he is."
For a moment the gusto vanished from Topar's stance. "A shame. Yes. A very great shame.
Did you know him, sir?"
"Not I, no. But I will take you to someone who did. He will want the details, I'm sure. Follow me."
He led them to an archway at the rear of the hall, and began to climb the broad stairs beyond. As he ascended, Ediard knew he had been right about whoever created the city not being human. The stairs were cumbrous, more like a slope of solidified ripples. They curved enough to provide an unsure footing, and their spacing was awkward for human legs. Ediard soon found himself sweating as they continued to climb around and around. His calf muscles were not used to such strenuous exercise. At one point, when they must have been 4 or 5 stories above the hall, Topar turned around to smirk at the two youngsters. He grunted, as if satisfied by their tribulation.
"Just imagine how much rounder I would be if I didn't have to negotiate these 5 times a day, eh?"
He chuckled and carried on. Ediard was panting heavily when they finally stopped in some kind of large anteroom. He had no idea how high they had climbed, but the top of the tower could surely be only a couple of feet above them. That altitude would explain how light-headed he had become.
"Wait here," Topar said,
and went through a wooden door bound with thick iron filigree. The walls of the anteroom were still red, but lighter than those of the lower floors. Overhead, the ceiling glowed a pale amber, turning Ediard's skin an unpleasant shade of grey. He dumped his shoulder bag on the floor and sank into a large chair of curving wooden ribs. Salrana sat on one next to him, looking thoroughly bewildered. "Are we in trouble or not?" she asked.
"I don't think I care any more. That pig of a sergeant. He knew we were harmless."
She smiled. "You're not." He was too tired to argue. His farsight was all but blocked by the tower walls, but he could sense two minds behind the wooden door. There was very little to discern about their emotional composition, but then, walking through the districts, he had noticed how adept city people were at guarding their feelings. Topar opened the door.
"You can come in now, Ediard. Novice Salrana, if you would be so kind as to indulge us for a moment longer. Someone will be here to take care of you momentarily."
Even before he went into the room, Ediard guessed he was being taken to Grand Master Finnitan. As he went in, he nearly faltered, as a farsight swept through him like a gust of cold air. The hair on the back of his arm stood up in reaction. A little thought occurred to him that if anyone could see through a psychic concealment, it would be this man. Grandmaster Finnitan sat in a high-back chair behind a large oak desk facing the door. His office must have taken up nearly a quarter of the tower at that level. It was huge, but almost empty. There was no furniture other than the desk and chair. Two of the walls were covered by bookshelves containing hundreds of leather-bound tomes. Behind him the wall was mostly crystal window with thin lian ribs, providing a view clear across Macathran. Ediard's jaw fell open. He only just managed to stop himself from running over and gawping like a delighted child. From what he could see at this angle, the undulating rooftops swept away for miles, while the canals cut through them like blue-gray arteries. Looking at it like this, he knew for certain that the city was alive. Here, humans were nothing more than foreign bacteria living in a body they could never comprehend fully.
"Quite a sight, isn't it?"
Grandmaster Finnitan said gently. In many respects, he was the physical opposite of Topar, slim and tall with thick hair down to his shoulder that was just beginning to grey. Yet his age was evident in the lines creasing his face. Despite that, his thoughts were tranquil. He was curious and affable rather than dismissive. Ediard shifted his gaze back to the Grand Master.
"Yes, sir. I apologize again for what happened downstairs."
The Grand Master raised a finger to his lips, and Ediard fell silent.
"No more of that," Finnitan said. "You've traveled a long way, yes?"
"From Rulan Province, sir." Finnitan and Topar exchanged a glance, smiling at some private joke.
"A long way," Finnitan said sagely. "Some tea."
His mind sent out a fast, long-talk instruction. Ediard turned to see a door open at the base of one of the bookshelf walls. It was too small for a man, barely 4 feet high. G-chimps scampered out, bringing a pair of chairs and a tray. The chairs were positioned in front of the Grand Master's desk, while the tray with its silver tea service was placed on the desk beside a cradle that held a Genistar egg.
"Sit down, my boy,"
Finnitan said.
"Now I understand you claim our colleague Akeem is dead."
"When did this happen?"
"Almost a year ago, sir." "Those are some very dark thoughts in your mind, accompanying that memory. Please tell me the story in its entirety. I believe I'm old enough to endure the full truth."
Embarrassed that his mind was so transparent, Ediard took a deep breath and began. Both the Grand Master and Topar were silent when he finished. Eventually, Finnitan rested his chin on steepled forefingers.
"Ah, my poor dear Akeem. For his life to end like that is an unforgivable tragedy. An entire village slaughtered by bandits. I find that extraordinary."
"It happened," Ediard said with a flash of anger.
"I'm not questioning your tale, my boy. I find the whole concept deeply disturbing, that there is some kind of society out in the wilds different from our own, and one which is so implacably hostile."
"They're animals," Ediard growled.
"No, that's your instinctive reaction, and a healthy one it is, too. But to organize such a raid is quite an accomplishment."
He sat back and drank some tea.
Could there really be a rival civilization somewhere out there beyond our maps? They have concealment techniques and fanciful weapons. I'd always believed such things were the province of this city alone. You have the repeat fire guns? Ediard asked. In all his travels, no one had ever heard of such a thing. A year of constant dismissal had made him doubt his memories of that terrible night. Finnerton and Topar exchanged another glance. No, and that is more worrying than knowing how to conceal yourself. But how lovely that Akeem knew the technique which is supposed to be practiced only by guildmasters. He was a master, sir. Of course. I mean those of us who sit on the council. Sadly, Akeem never achieved that. It was politics, of course. I'm afraid to say, young Ediard, that you are going to learn life here in the city is all about politics. Yes, sir. Did you know Akeem, sir? Finnerton smiled. Have you not worked it out yet, my boy? Dear me, I thought you were quicker. We share a bond, you and I. For he was my master when I was a lowly young apprentice here. Oh, which means you present me with a very unpleasant problem. I do, Ediard said anxiously. You have no formal letter of confirmation from your master. Worse than that, with your village gone, we cannot ever confirm that you were taken in by the guild. Ediard smiled uncertainly. But I know how to sculpt an egg. His farsight swept through the egg on the Grand Master's desk, revealing the folded shadows of the embryo inside. You have sculpted a G-dog. I don't recognize some of the traits. You're outside the traditional form, but it is a dog. 2 days from hatching, I'd guess. Topar nodded in appreciation. Impressive. Akeem was the best master, Ediard said hotly. Finnerton's sigh was heavier than before. You have obviously received guild training, and you clearly have skills as well as strength. And that is the problem. I don't understand, sir. You say Akeem made you a journeyman. Yes, sir. I cannot accept you into the guild at that level. I know this seems intolerably harsh, Ediard, but there are formalities which even I have to follow. Ediard was aware that his cheeks were burning. It was not quite anger, but all he could think of was the pettiness of the guildmaster back in Thorpe by Water. Surely the Grand Master, the leader of the whole Eggshaper Guild, could not be so small-minded. What he said was law to the guild. I see. I doubt it, but I do sympathize with the exasperation you must feel. I will be delighted to accept you into the guild here in Macathran, Ediard, but it must be as a junior apprentice. I cannot make exceptions, especially not in your case. What do you mean? To acknowledge your journeyman status without a formal letter from your master will lay me open to a charge of favoritism from others on the guild council.
Politics, Topar said.
I understand, Ediard whispered. He was frightened that he was going to burst into tears in front of them. To get to Macathran, to be in the presence of the Grand Master, and then to be told that all he had achieved was worthless because he lacked a piece of paper. Pardon me, but that's stupid, sir, he said sullenly. It's much worse than that, but I appreciate your politeness, my boy. Ediard sniffed and wiped his nose. How long would it take me to get back to being a journeyman? Here at the Blue Tower, and assuming you have the appropriate talent? 7 years. Appointing you a journeyman at your age was ambitious, even for Akeem, but at the same time, so very typical of him. 7 years, Ediard repeated numbly. 7 years of repeating every lesson and knowledge gift he'd ever undergone. 7 years of having to hold himself back. 7 years of obedience to journeymen less able than himself. 7 years. I know what you're thinking, and I'm not even using farsight, Finnerton said gently. It is a terrible thing to ask you to undergo. I'm not sure I can, Ediard said. I thought when I came here that I wanted nothing more than to be a part of the guild, but now, these formalities. Akeem always said I would find them difficult. I thought he was teasing. Listen to me, Ediard, Finnerton said, for I am about to say something which borders on the sacrilegious. Sir, the hierarchy we have in the guilds
not just ours but all guilds, exists for those who seek to further themselves within our political system. Talent in your chosen field plays a part, but always it is a matter of money and politics. This is the way things are here in the capital. If you were not born into a grand family and have ambition, then you join a guild and fight your way to the top. Now consider that very carefully, because this is a choice that will decide the rest of your life for you. Is the Egg-Shaper Guild what you truly want? It's what I wanted, and I have achieved my goal. I am Grand Master. But look at the battles I have to fight, on every level. I am surrounded with so many people seeking the same thing, seeking this seat in this office, that I cannot make an exception for someone as gifted as yourself, because 100 years ago I had a master who went on to teach you. Is that sanity, Ediard? Is that the life you want for yourself? To have 12 such considerations every day, to be unable to put a foot wrong, to continue a tradition no matter how dry and worthless it is, because that is what supports you. To be unable to change, even though change was the one thing above all that used to drive you. That is what I am, Ediard. That is what Topar is. I despair of myself at times, of how helpless I have become, entrapped in the very system I once wanted to alter and improve. But, sir, if you don't make changes, who can? Nobody can, Ediard. Not now. Not in these times. Our society is mature. Change is instability. That is why every institution we have resists change. To maintain the status quo is our sole objective in life. That's wrong. Yes, it is. But what do you want to do about it? Do you want to spend 7 years working your ass off to become a journeyman? To make that first real step toward receiving master status? At which point your talent is irrelevant and the politicking begins in earnest? You build allies and make enemies on every council on which you sit in order to gain greater power and control. But it is only power and control over the councils. Ultimately, it amounts to very little. Are you saying I should go back and join the caravan? No. My offer to admit you to the guild is genuine and remains open while I am Grand Master. Who knows? Maybe you will make a difference if you make it to this office. I should tell you now that nobody under 100 years old has ever sat here.
I don't know, Ediard said helplessly.
There is one alternative. You already know how to sculpt eggs. By joining the guild, you would be acknowledging that your life is now oriented to a political goal. However, the city constables are always seeking recruits. It is a noble profession. My position on the upper council allows me to sponsor you into their ranks. They would delight in accepting someone with such a strong third hand, and this city desperately needs men of good stature to enforce the law. Without that, we will all become nothing.
A constable. He was not even sure what a constable was.
Even a city as sophisticated as Macathran has crime, Ediard. Decent people, especially those in the poorer districts, live in fear of gangs that roam the streets at night. Merchants suffer thefts and increase their prices accordingly, which injures everyone. You would be helping people directly and immediately. Unlike the other guilds, constable apprentices are not tucked away out of sight, toiling to make their master's life easy. The hierarchy of the constables is a lot less complex than that of any normal guild. The prospect for advancement is good. You're smart and strong. I will not delude you that it is an easy life, for it is not. But you've even been in a real life-or-death fight, which is more than any other recruit has done. You should do well.
I'm not sure.
Of course not. I didn't expect you to give me an answer immediately. You need time to think about your future. What you decide now determines the rest of your life. Why don't you escort your friend to her church? Then take a good look around. Get a feel for the city before you make up your mind. If you want to give the constables a try, long talk Topar here, and we will arrange for your admission.
Thank you, sir.
You are welcome. And Ediard?
Sir,
I'm glad Akeem had such a gifted pupil at the end. It wouldn't have been easy for him in Ashwell. You must have helped enrich his life considerably.
Thank you. Edyard rose from the seat, knowing his time was up.
Sir,
why did Akeem leave the Blue Tower? Finnerton smiled fondly.
He was like you, my boy. He wanted to make a difference, to help people. Here he could do very little. Outside our crystal wall, in Ashwell, I suspect he had a profound effect on the lives of the villagers.
Yes, sir. He did.
What happened in there?
Salrana demanded when Edyard reappeared in the anteroom.
You don't seem very happy.
I'm not, he admitted, and picked up his shoulder bag. Come on. We need to get you to the church before nightfall. I'll tell you what happened on the way.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.